The students, all Wing Commanders of RAF and Commonwealth Air Forces, flew in a number of aircraft, Meteors, Hunters and Canberras, and completed the navigation syllabus on Lancaster. The Flying College had promoted the Ares series of aircraft, which finished up with Ares 5, which was a specially modified Canberra, stuffed with fuel tanks in every available space. The normal Canberra weighed about 35,000 pounds and Ares 5 carried a further 50,000 pounds of fuel. The fuel tanks were divided into two parts and you drew on the second half of the fuel with a simple on-off switch. On a dark night over the North Pole, you gingerly turned on the on switch and prayed it would release the second series of tanks. I undertook one or two polar flights on Ares 5 and then flew direct to Aden. The tanks were filled up to overflowing at Mansion and we were towed out by a tractor to the end of the runway where we launched off, taking the whole 5,000 yards of the runway to stagger into the air. It was too hot at Aden to try a direct return flight. I was then posted to Command RAF Wattisham. This was the premier fighter station with three squadrons, No. 111 Squadron, who flew the aerobatic team Le Black Arrows with Hunters, No. 56 Squadron with Hunters, and No. 43 Squadron with Javelins. Again, I was being offered the chance to make my mark. I did a short javelin conversion course at RAF Leeming. The javelin had an evil reputation, largely due to the test pilot Bill Waterton's reluctance to undertake spinning trials, but I always found the aircraft delightful to fly. The only thing you did not do was to stall the aircraft or, even worse, spin it, since it really did not like recovering from a spin. My instructor explained this very carefully to me and then accidentally put the aircraft into an inverted spin, terrifying us both. One of my jobs as station commander was to accompany 111 Squadron on their overseas tours to make sure that they behaved themselves prior to an air show and particularly that they got to bed by midnight before performing the following day. The commanding officer was Squadron Leader Peter Latham and his normal show was performed by 9 aircraft. My own cross in that squadron was a young pilot called Clayton Jones. We clashed on numerous occasions and I always came off worst. The first time I met him was at a show in Spain when Peter Latham pulled his team rather close to the runway after a loop and then wheeled the formation round to pull up into a roll. Clayton Jones, who was always the wingman, finished up very close to the ground and as Latham pulled up there was chattering on the radio. Latham always insisted on radio silence in the formation so that he could get his next orders out crisply and clearly. On the debriefing afterwards, Latham said, "Sorry chaps, I pulled out of that loop rather low but there was some chatter on the radio. It sounded like you, CJ." "What was the trouble?" "Nothing," replied CJ, "I just wanted to die talking." On another occasion, at Lyon in France, I had briefed everyone to be in bed by midnight for an 11 o'clock performance the following morning. I came down to breakfast to meet CJ just coming through the swing doors of the hotel wearing dark glasses. "Good morning, CJ," I said, "glad to see you are up so early." "Good morning, sir," replied CJ. "I have not just got up. I am just going to bed." Embarrassingly for a station commander, I broke my elbow at a particularly rough dining in night. Of course, the officer responsible for this painful event was none other than my friend Clayton Jones. Wattisham had been selected as the first operational Lightning station. The Lightning had been an English Electric experimental aircraft and was rushed into service after the Americans had found the sound barrier was no barrier after all. It was built just like a missile, two massive reheated Olympus engines slung under a fuselage. The aircraft was a delight to fly but pretty useless as an air defense fighter since the Mark 1 only had 40 minutes endurance and its radar was particularly useless. It also suffered from many teething troubles, electrically and mechanically. I had great difficulty in persuading one particularly nervous pilot to stay with this aircraft. He was in the habit of trying to eject. when practicing a quick climb to height, a vital part of any air defense fighter's role, the drill was to fly out to sea at Mach 9, accelerate to Mach 2 at 35,000 feet and pull up to 55,000 feet in a straight line, and then recover back to base. Once, when I was feeling particularly brave, I went on pulling back, topping out at about 70,000 feet and dropping like a brick back to Mother Earth. Because Wat Isham was the premier fighter station and because of my royal background, I collected all royal visitors to fighter command from King Hussein to Prince Philip. The record was 3 in 1 month. You put one set of props away and then pulled out the next one. I was even criticized by the headlines in a newspaper tabloid which read, "Station commander orders plastic daffodils to be planted for royal visitor." This was quite untrue. Some wag had done it as a joke. But what I do remember was that when Princess Alexandra visited the station, my wife was supposed to present her with a bouquet of flowers outside the family center and a RAF officer was detailed to produce a suitable bouquet. The great moment arrived and Princess Alexandra appeared in an official car. "Bouquet," someone cried. "Bouquet," was echoed, but no bouquet. The RAF officer had forgotten. My wife, with considerable presence of mind, hurriedly picked a bunch of daffodils from the bed around the family center and thrust it into the hands of the princess, who was quite charming. "What a beautiful bunch of fresh flowers." She didn't know just how fresh they were. It was also on Princess Alexandra's visit that I made a howler much echoed around the Air Council on what not to say during a royal visit. We had arranged a hunter formation after lunch with the letters PA on the way to luncheon, followed by a line of air marshals. Princess Alexandra said, "Peter, I hear you are flying in a formation after lunch." Without thinking, I said, "Oh, Mom, we are doing a POVU as well." She howled with laughter, but the following air marshals were not amused. I still kept hitting the headlines. No 111 squadron was scheduled to make a flypast on the birth of a royal baby, and the headlines in the Express ran, "Group Captain Horsley, the Queen's old equerry, said, 'My boys are ready to christen the royal child.' I wished the earth could have opened and swallowed me up." On another occasion, I reluctantly agreed to give a television interview to a presenter who I believed was an old friend, on 111 Squadron's aerobatic prowess. They had just completed a record number of 22 hunters in a loop over Farnborough. I agreed to this interview provided Colin Hodgkinson made no mention of my past royal connections, which he promised to do. In the live broadcast, he started with the words, "Now, Group Captain, you were of course equerry to the Duke of Edinburgh. What do you think about?" So much for promises. While at Wat Isham, I learned the essential qualities of leadership. I flew with all the squadrons, including No 111 Squadron, on aerobatic sorties in the dual hunter with Peter Latham at the controls. For my farewell dining in night, I had briefed the wing that morning that I did not want to see any horseplay at dinner until after the Queen's health had been drunk. They were all so quiet and well behaved at dinner that I thought I had ruined the evening. As soon as the Queen's health had been drunk, there was bedlam. Through every door and every window, piles of burning pillow feathers were thrown into the room, and within seconds visibility had dropped to less than a yard, and so it went on throughout the night. My next post was as Group Captain, Operations, at headquarters near East Air Forces NEAF, in Cyprus, this time with far more experience and confidence. I was the only staff officer to have a jeep, and I lived a very pampered life, starting work at 7 o'clock and packing up at lunchtime, which left plenty of spare time for the beach or riding. The staff had been worried about the station commander of Akrotiri, which was the major flying base in the Near and Middle East, as he never seemed to have a grip either of his station or the flying wing. I found him a charming man, polite and intelligent, but very short on flying experience, about 500 hours on special duty Lysanders during the war. He had been a planner and was completely miscast as an operations station commander. My old squadron, No 111, now re-equipped with Lightnings, were due to fly to Akrotiri in about 2 months' time. The station commander could not really face up to it. He kept putting off decisions on how to recover them. I did not wield the axe. In fact, I did my best to protect him, but, what was worse, his wing commander flying was also not up to the job, never having gone solo on the Canberra, which was the main aircraft of the station. The pair of them usually made a hash of things. The senior air staff officer, Air Vice Marshal Worrell, got fed up with the situation and decided that the station commander had to go. I was dispatched to tell him. He took it very badly, but in his heart of hearts I think it was a great relief. We had to find an immediate replacement, but the ministry in consultation decided it would take at least 6 months to find a Canberra-trained one. I knew what was in the wind when my commander-in-chief, Sir Dennis Barnett, sent for me and said, "Peter, I want you to go down tomorrow and take over a Akrotiri." I replied that I didn't really want to go for a number of reasons. First, I had just finished as a station commander in Fighter Command and my contemporaries would not look kindly on my becoming a station commander again, and, second, as a station commander's job was expensive, I did not want to bear the personal cost of another. My commander-in-chief was quite succinct. "Peter," he said, "I am not asking you, I am ordering you." So the following day I presented myself at the guardroom. On being asked to identify myself, I replied that I was the new station commander and that they had better learn to recognize me. I had sufficient experience to realize that the next 6 months were going to be very tough indeed. I went to see the station commander in his office and asked him to leave the station within 24 hours. He went quietly and was posted to a backwater staff post in Sento at Ankara. I don't think he ever recovered and left the RAF some time later. It was a pity he had ever been given a frontline station. Had he been given a planning job in the Ministry of Defence, or even a training station, he had the intellect to become a very senior officer. The wing commander flying had to go as well, so I gave him his marching orders. That day at lunch I was avoided by the whole station and ate in splendid isolation. The first thing I now did was to parade the 5 squadron commanders in front of me. With a weak wing commander flying, they had been allowed to do exactly what they liked, but I told them that I had also taken on the job of wing commander flying and that I expected to fly with all their squadrons, so they had better follow orders in future. They didn't like it and had the nerve to say so. "All right," I said, "think it over and let me know tomorrow if you would like to follow the wing commander flying." From then on I never had a squeak out of any of them and they became the most loyal of subordinates. Eventually I formed a Canberra wing with 5 squadrons and a wing commander and my old friend Peter Latham arrived as the Canberra wing leader. Just before No. 111 Squadron were due with their lightnings, I sent a signal to their commanding officer, Dickie Wordnam, telling them to bring their dinner jackets with them as there was a black tie function in the mess. They duly landed, an event for which we had arranged a press reception. They seemed to be spending a lot of time in their cockpits, but on command of their commanding officer they came down the ladders all resplendent in dinner jackets. In the Mark 1 Lightnings they had had to plan for a 9 flight refueling hookup to get them to Akrotiri, and there was a story at the time that one pilot stayed hooked up for the whole flight, like a baby at its mother's breast. That Christmas all hell broke loose and I was rung up by the NEAF operations room at 5 o'clock in the morning to be told that a Turkish invasion fleet had been sighted off the Cyprus coast and that I was to start the evacuation of 6,000 Limassol families through Akrotiri immediately. We had practiced the evacuation beforehand and it all worked like clockwork. By this time I had the whole station on my side and they understood what leadership was about. I had thoroughly professional wing commanders under me and had the wonderful feeling of a ship's captain that I only had to turn the wheel and the ship would respond easily and quickly. The Greeks started slaughtering Turks and the whole island blew up. Gradually fighting became a battle between the north and the south, with small pockets of Turks being eliminated. RAF Nicosia had to be evacuated and I received all their aeroplanes at Akrotiri, a squadron of Javelin fighters and a transport squadron of Hastings. Since Suez, Akrotiri had been expanding rapidly and I had a huge building program on my hands, including a new lightning fighter dispersal and hangar and a large transport dispersal. We had a fairly efficient plan to deal with all this, but the evacuation of Nicosia filled Akrotiri to overflowing, so much so that I had to create a temporary officer's mess in a disused hangar. There were now 9 wing commanders under me, besides a group captain commanding the hospital, rather a wide span of command. Even in the best-run organizations, there will be moments of disaster. I was showing a parliamentary delegation around the station and was with them in the sergeant's mess, standing up against a window explaining the problems of running such a large station. I saw the MP's eyes widening as they stared out of the window behind me, and eventually one said, "Excuse me, group captain, but there is a large fire burning behind your back." "It's perfectly all right," I replied. "We have a very efficient fire brigade." However, when I eventually turned round, I saw the officer's mess blazing fiercely in the background. "Excuse me," I said and ran out. Lightning had struck the roof and within seconds the whole building was ablaze. I met the PMC rushing out with the monthly mess bills in his arms. "For God's sake, put them back," I yelled. Rather bravely, so I thought, I went into the burning building to make sure that everyone was out of it and found a lone RAF officer standing on a chair taking the curtains down under a red-hot roof. "For God's sake, get out," I yelled as the roof began to fall around her. Of course, when the hose pipes were hooked up and a very efficient commanding officer of the fire brigade shouted, "Turn the water on," only a thin trickle looped out from the end of the pipe. The mess burned down completely and the MPs stayed in the sergeant's mess for an excellent lunch. A new mess was built just up the road and the old one was repaired, so in the end I had plenty of room to house my 600 officers. When I left Wattisham, I had thought that I had finally got rid of Clayton Jones. I should have known better. I led a Canberra practice raid from Akrotiri, bombing the range at Ellerdem in the early morning and then landing at the local RAF station. As a visiting group captain, I was given a VIP bedroom in the officers' transit mess. I had just got into my pajamas when I heard the sound of someone playing a very squeaky violin in the room next door. The noise was so excruciating that I donned my group captain's jacket over my pajamas and roared next door to deliver a blistering attack on the offender. It was, of course, Clayton Jones, who was on a hunter armament practice camp. I knew I was on a hiding to nothing, so I meekly said, "Good morning, CJ," and retired hurt back to my room to cry. On my return to England, the air secretary interviewed me and said, "You need a rest, Peter, so I am sending you to the Imperial Defence College for a year." He was right. It was a rest consisting of a 10:30 lecture followed by lunch and golf afterwards. At the end of the course, the secretary got up and asked us to return any books to the library. I have to admit I didn't even know there was a library. I was now posted as deputy commandant at the Joint Warfare Establishment, JWE, at Trafold Sarum. I hadn't a clue where or what the JWE was, but it sounded like the kiss of death to me. In fact, it was only a stopover. At the end of my tour, I was promoted to Air Vice Marshal as Assistant Chief of the Air Staff, Operations. Meanwhile, I had created another school, the Joint Air Transport Establishment, and was its first commandant. It was at Old Sarum that I met my future wife, although we didn't get married until 10 years later when she had shed a husband and I had shed a wife. My new appointment was the first time I had ever served in Whitehall and it proved a great cultural shock. There were 3 assistant chiefs, of whom ACA, Operations, was primus pairs, taking over from the vice chief when he was away. The first excitement was that Northern Ireland blew up one Saturday morning. Between us, an army colonel and I transported 5,000 reinforcements there over the weekend. On Monday, the chief of the air staff sent for me and said, "Peter, you might have asked me or at least told me what you were doing. So I learn my first Whitehall lesson, tell everyone, including the cleaners, what you are going to do. It is better to have the civil servants on your side than against you. I also learned, among much else, how to answer a telephone at any time of the day or night and answer in a perfectly clear voice, a habit which still lasts. I had a series of other crises to deal with during my time as ACA, Ops, the overthrow of the king in Libya and the seizure of the Ruff airfield at El Adem, the revolt against the king in Jordan, the invasion of Hungary by the Soviet Union, the closure of the border between Gibraltar and Spain by the Spanish and the invasion of Anguilla. For the latter I was in charge of the operational planning for all our transport operations. I resisted sending in bombers as there was only one light aircraft on the airfield. I attended innumerable meetings with the army, civil servants and foreign office, all of which were conducted in the utmost secrecy. Instead of using the normal security procedure, endorsing documents top secret, secret, and so on, everything was conducted by word of mouth. As a result, the operation escalated and it seemed as though the entire British Defence Force had turned on a tiny island and was about to subject it to a mighty invasion. In Whitehall, all business is conducted by large meetings and I was required to chair one such on the invasion plan in one of four adjacent conference rooms. I went down the corridor and opened a door to face a long table of 40 people, so I sat down in the chairman's place at the head of the table. After about 20 minutes, in which a number of people spoke about overflying African territories, I brought the proceedings to a halt and said, "Gentlemen, what has overflying African territories to do with the invasion of Anguilla?" One of the members stood up and said, "Mr. Chairman, this meeting is about overflying." I apologized and hurriedly left the room. Whereupon another gentleman hurrying down the corridor bumped into me and said, "Who are you?" I replied, "Anguilla, but who are you?" He said, "I am overflying African territories, but for the last 20 minutes I have been chairing a meeting on the invasion of Anguilla." Anguilla was really the biggest cock-up since Mons. When our troops stormed ashore they couldn't find any enemy, all five of them had left the island the previous day. I was responsible for the clearance of all aircraft. At one meeting I mentioned the clearance of our air transport aircraft full of troops through the RAF station, Goose Bay, on their way to Anguilla. Frank Cooper, the Royal Air Force permanent undersecretary, gesticulated to me that it was all in hand. On the day, of course, the Canadians, to their horror, found a British invasion being mounted through one of their stations and they sent all the transport aircraft hurrying back to England. Mr. Trudeau, the Canadian Prime Minister, rang Harold Wilson at midnight complaining bitterly of the invasion of his territory. I was left holding the baby and it looked as though I was for the high jump. Fortunately, Frank Cooper admitted his mistake, but I still had to fly to Canada to make a personal apology, although no one in Ottawa believed my version of the story. The Prime Minister had a paranoia about leaks to the press. This resulted in everything being passed on by word of mouth rather than using the secure signals traffic. For example, over the Anguilla operation, I had personally to go and visit the Commander-in-Chief Transport Command to instruct him to get his transport aircraft ready to fly west about 3,000 miles to an island beginning with an A and ending with an A and that his crews would have to wear tropical kit. Of course, with the telephone buzzing between Whitehall, Aldershot and Upper Avon, it was not long before an operator had sorted it all out and briefed the press accordingly. Hence, the day before the invasion was due to begin, the story came out in the headlines of the tabloids. The Prime Minister also believed that it took his personal intervention to solve the pressing problems of the day. He had decided therefore to interfere personally in the Nigerian/Biafran civil war. In consequence, I found myself having to organize the provision of two VC-10 aircraft, one with Prestige fit for the VIPs and one as backup, to fly to Lagos, where it was expected the talks would be held. In addition, to cater for the possibility of the need for any internal flying in and out of Biafra, an Andover and a supporting Hercules had to be positioned. The possibility of the party having also to call in at Addis Ababa had to be taken into account as well. All in all, it was a very expensive and rather complicated exercise. The PM set off on his travels, surrounded by an enormous entourage. Despite the considerable expenditure of time and effort involved, let alone the cost, his mission came to naught. Denis Healy was the Minister for Defence at this time and had the habit of tasking the staffs on a Friday afternoon to write a paper over the weekend for his perusal on the Monday, which, apart from the workload, I suppose was better than the normal habit of ministers making their decisions by flipping a coin. The only time I really met him was at a meeting in the company of the Chief of the Air Staff, Air Chief Marshal Sir John Grandy. On my appointment as Assistant Chief, I had also inherited the chairmanship of a standing committee called Linesman, Mediator, which was made up of about 40 people from Air Traffic, Post Office and Uncle Tom Coverley and all. It had been established to bring the large and complex Air Traffic Defence Centre at West Drayton into operation. The centre had been planned some 10 years earlier as an integrated civil, military air traffic and defence centre on a forecast of future computer technology which proved far too optimistic. When I took over the steering committee, there was not a hope of it ever reaching fruition, despite the fact that £120 million had already been spent on large banks of already redundant Plessy computers. I was briefed by my predecessor that it would be much wiser never to let the subject out of the committee room and to hand it over to my successor after 3 years. Unfortunately, we had to approach the Treasury for more money and it was necessary to leak it out of the door, where it exploded among the politicians. It ended up on Denis Healy's desk and so I met with him and cast to decide its fate. Sir John Grandy put it all into one sentence: "Minister, if you want to see Russian bombers flying at 500 feet past Westminster and Parliament, you can cancel it." At the word Parliament, Denis Healy blanched and said, "All right, Kaz, carry on." However, in the end, Linesman/Mediator proved to be my downfall, as the Commander-in-Chief Bomber Command had set his mind against it and tried to get the Vice Chief to cancel it. Having got little change out of Kaz, he rang me up and said, "Peter, I want you to cancel it." I replied that I only took orders from Vkas and not from commanders in chief. This cooked my goose as far as my future career was concerned. It was decided by the Air Force Board rather late in the day that the RAF would enter the Daily Mail transatlantic air race, which took place in 1969. The Royal Navy had already entered Phantoms, which the RAF had agreed to support with Victor tankers, and I was given the rather thankless task of assembling and directing the RAF sentries. It seemed pointless to enter RAF Phantoms to compete with the Navy. Happily, a member of my staff came up with the brilliant idea of entering the Harrier. To do so required us to push forward its flight refueling capability with RAF Boscombe Down and to find a suitable site in London close to the starting point, the Post Office Tower. We explored a lot of sites, including the parks, which were ideal, giving plenty of room in case of an engine failure on takeoff, but no one would give us permission to use them. The only site we could find close enough to the Post Office Tower was a coal yard next to St. Pancras Station. It belonged to British Rail, who enthusiastically gave us permission to use it. In marked contrast with the obstructionists that we had encountered in London, the Mayor of New York, on the other hand, gave us tremendous support, knowing the publicity value for his city. Indeed, he wanted us to land on the Empire State Building, which was the finishing point. However, we settled on a schoolyard next door to the United Nations building. The questions still being raised within MOD were endless. However, once I had satisfied him about the safety aspects of landing and taking off a Harrier in the middle of London and the effect upon the local residents of the noise and coal dust from the coal yard, Lord Winterbotham, the Under Secretary of State RAF, supported our efforts against most of his ministerial colleagues. Nevertheless, he actually visited the site himself and spoke to the people living nearby. I had sworn blind that there would be no dust on the day, for I had arranged for the coal dust to be damped down by an immense amount of water. In the event, I went down to the site to watch the first landing. The pilot approached over the railway station, lifting off its tin roof and disappearing in a cloud of the accumulated coal dust of centuries. My eyes didn't recover from the grit for days afterwards. Unfortunately, the television cameras filmed the landing. Once he had seen it on the news, Lord Winterbotham rang me to say, "No dust, Hacker, ops."